Welcome to the world of Culture Pop with Steve Mason and Sue Kowinski. Culture,
comedy, movies, TV, tech, authors, trends,
pop. This is the Culture Pop Podcast.
Our guest began his Broadway career at the age of only 10 years old, went on to originate the role of Mark Cohen in Jonathan Larson's Rent, easily my favorite Broadway show of all time. His movies include Adventures in Babysitting and School Ties and Dazed and Confused. And these days he's starring as Lieutenant Commander Paul Stamets on the hit series Star Trek Discovery on CBS All Access. Anthony Rapp joins us. Anthony, thanks a lot for coming on, man.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Hello. So we are not experts on Star Trek. Were you an expert when you started? Were you originally a Trekkie?
I wouldn't have called myself an expert, but I was definitely a fan. I've been a nerd and an aficionado of science fiction and fantasy and comic book stuff since Dungeons and Dragons, all that stuff since I was a little kid. I used to watch the original series after school. So I knew Kirk and Spock, and I saw a couple, like three of the original movies when I was a kid when they were released in the like late 70s, early 80s. But I hadn't watched any of the other series really, mostly because I was happily working in theater a lot, and that this was before TiVo, before you could, you know, easily, well, I guess I could have done VCR, but I just wasn't watching TV, so I wasn't like watching any of Next Gen or Voyager or any of those other shows. But when I got cast in 2016, I think it was, I just did like a deep dive and started watching a bit of all of them. A good friend of mine is a huge Trekkie, and he gave me like a curated list, and I was, one of the great things about that was I knew who Patrick Stewart was, obviously, but I didn't know how brilliant he was in that show and how brilliant Brent Spiner was as Data and Jonathan Frakes as Riker. It was another level of, it gave me a lot of hope and inspiration as I was about to go into this show that it was, there was an opportunity for really good acting, really good character storytelling and acting moments. It wasn't just about like running around pew pew with a laser gun or a phaser. You know, there's Star Trek goes deeper than the sort of typical kind of sci-fi thing.
You know, as Steve has said, you know, I'm not a Trekkie at all. Probably the last time I saw Star Trek was, you know, was when William Shatner was Kirk.
Yeah.
And watching, the characters like fluidly being able to speak in a way that to me is so foreign. Is it difficult? Like, you know, when I watch shows where actors have to play doctors, you know, mm-hmm. in order for us to believe that they really are doctors, it has to seem that real and fluid. Was that difficult for you?
Here. We combine the data from Navarre with the data from Commander Burnham's black boxes. This is where the burn started. The Verubin Nebula. Unusually intense radiation, highly unstable electromagnetic fields.
Okay. So we have a point of origin.
I wouldn't call it difficult. It's definitely challenging in moments, but our writers are always consulting with actual scientists. So even when things in our show, you know, go out the realm of like true known science, it's based on at least theoretical science. So we always have resources that we can go to learn a little bit more about what we're talking about. So it's not just like made up gobbledygook. And that helps. And it's not that dissimilar in a way from doing like Shakespeare, in the sense that when you're doing Shakespeare, you also have to find a way to bring heightened language to life convincingly. So it goes back to like why I'm not surprised that somebody like Bill Shatner, I think, did some Shakespeare and theater stuff, but you know, Patrick Stewart was a trained Shakespearean actor. It doesn't surprise me that he was able to fold that kind of training into Star Trek, because we're asked also not only to do all this jargon, but kind of stretch our imaginations to include, you know, otherworldly beings and all these other, you know, the realm of the possible. And that's something that Shakespeare asks of you too, when you're in, you know, the Scottish play or Hamlet, you're talking to ghosts and witches and all that kind of stuff. I think it's not that different in a way.
So you play an astromycologist. For a layman, what is that?
Hey,
That's highly sensitive.
Stand back.
Is this how it's gonna be everywhere we go? At least Earth would feel like home. You're not listening.
What are you doing? Don't touch that.
Why is that cube connected to your vessel's bridge controls?
This is a science research vessel. I'm an astromycologist. I use the cube for controlled spore reactions, which requires coordination with the bridge.
This science vessel's practically a museum. Okay, well, museums are cool, so that's what someone who lives in a museum would say. You live in a museum.
How old are you? 17?
16.
Would you please remove your 16-year-old fingers from my life's work? What did I just say?
This is an interface of some kind.
Okay, we get it. You're smart. Everybody here is smart.
Well, it's my character, Paul Stamets, the name is inspired by a real mycologist named Paul Stamets, who's doing really cutting edge, amazing work in the field of mycology, which is around mushrooms and mycelium and spores and fun. He pronounces it fungi. And so he does like really innovative work in that domain. And one of our original series creators has always been really impressed by him. And he thought it'd be cool to kind of put that science into Star Trek. So, if I'm going to try to do it as succinctly as possible. So if you're in a forest and you're walking around a forest, there's mycelium, which are like these microscopic, organisms under the forest floor, right. And they've discovered that they actually communicate with each other. Like if your foot steps on the forest floor, then there's like a network of mycelia that communicate across the forest and kind of respond. And our writer has extrapolated that. What if that also exists like in space or subspace? And so my character works in that field, in that domain.
You know, the sets are insanely, they're just insane. And, you know, when watching it on television, the ship looks massive. What does it actually look like, and where do you shoot this?
It's actually pretty big. We shoot it in Toronto at the Pinewood Studios, and they're the biggest, I believe, have been, I don't know if they still are, but one of the very biggest sound stages in all of North America. Like the corridors of our ship, like that's all real. That we have very little green screen when we're filming on the ship itself. Everything is practical. Those screens that are on the bridge, they're all real. The only thing that, like, when we're on the bridge, when we're looking out the view screen, that's green screen. Obviously, we're not looking at stars and planets for real. But everything else is very tactile, and it's very immediate, and enormous care goes into it. You know, and there's always the trick of like, we have a whole circular hallway. And so sometimes you have to like, if you're a director and you're trying to do something different, you have to pick that section of the hallway versus that section of the hallway and turn the camera around and make it look like you might be in a different part of the ship, or they might light it a little differently. But that goes back into the early days of Trek too. But yeah, these sets are like solid and real, and it helps so much to immerse us into the experience.
Star Trek has always been about inclusion. I mean, on the original series, Nichelle Nichols inspired African Americans, and George Takei inspired Asian Americans. And now in Discovery, you play a gay character, a character who's actually got a relationship. What's the impact that's had on the show and on people who follow the Star Trek mythology?
Well, I think that there's been always a huge contingent of Star Trek fans have been in the queer community, and they've been kind of hungry for that kind of representation. It's kind of funny to me, but in the early days of the fandom, there was like fan fiction that was about Spock and Kirk maybe having a romantic relationship. There's been a longing in the queer Trek fan community for representation. So when I got fortunate enough to be cast as Stamets, and then my longtime friend and an ex-Rent fellow cast member, Wilson Cruz, was cast as my partner on the show. We've been activists as well as actors for all these years. So we were very mindful of the opportunity that this was to kind of fly that flag and represent in that way. And it was very, very meaningful. And the response has been incredible from so many, not just older Trek fans who've been waiting for it, but also newer Trek fans who are themselves like looking for representation now and happily embracing it. And this past season, in season 3 that just finished airing, the queer character representation expanded to include the first ever non-binary character and the first ever trans character. And then also Tig Notaro has come on as a recurring guest role as a first openly lesbian character. So it's like the queerest Trek ever, but that's just in keeping with, like, you know, Gene Roddenberry always wanted the population of the crew to be as diverse as possible to show that in the future, those things that currently separate us in some circles won't separate us anymore. It's part of representing the vision of the future, that it's a sort of utopian ideal that these differences between us won't matter in the sense that they won't interfere with our ability to be ourselves and to be given responsibility and all that. There won't be, all that stuff is just sort of handled. It still is, in, you know, it's still central to our characters, but it doesn't matter in the sense of it's not problematic.
Is it weird, kind of surreal that that now you're starring in the show with Wilson Cruz, who played Angel in Rent? He plays your love interest here. How'd that come about?
It was just a really fun coincidence. I'd gotten cast, and then I was like waiting to hear like who, the character's name is Hugh, who Hugh was going to be. And I got a text from him. He's like, I just want to let you know that I'm in the running for it. And I was just crossing my fingers, cause it'd be, I know him and I know that he's a really good person and a good actor, but you know, so much of when you're on a long running, what I would think would be a long running TV show is, you know, you're together so much and working really hard together. And I just wanted to be good people. Like that's so much a part of the experience is being surrounded by, you know, well-mannered, conscientious, hardworking people who aren't going to be, you know, a-holes. So,
yeah.
So I was really, really happy when he was in the running. And then I was very happy when he got cast. Cause then I, you know, there's a level of comfort and trust and mutual respect. And, you know, I've known him for all these years. So yeah, it was a really nice, good fortune moment. And, you know, and he had some ups and downs in the years prior to his being cast. Like he had been sort of contemplating maybe even taking a step away from acting for a while. And So I was just really happy for him on that level too.
You've spent, you know, a lot of your career on stage and, you know, seeing you, you know, doing TV and movies, it's great. But, you know, I was wondering if you had been offered a stage role and a TV or movie role at the same time and money was irrelevant, What would you choose?
I mean, if it's like both are really great roles, because so much of it is the role and the material and the people involved. I mean, there'd be multiple factors, but if all those things were equal, then yes, stage I would do the theater piece. If all factors, I mean, I'm not talking, like you said, money was not the factor. If all the other criteria kind of lined up, then yeah, stage would take precedence.
So, you know, the night Rent is... I'll tell you, when I lived in New York, I was going through a tougher period in my life, mental health stuff and all that. And it was a really tough job. And so if I had a bad week, I would go to see Rent. Mm. And I probably saw Rent. Sue was joking. I probably saw it every weekend. I saw it at least 20 or 30 times while I lived in New York. I absolutely loved the show. And I've always wondered, you know, the night before Rent opened off Broadway, the creator and composer, Jonathan Larson, suddenly died. He was only 35 years old. Did you guys go on that next night? And what was the impact on the show because of that?
Yeah, I mean, it was the dress rehearsal that he was alive for and he saw, and it was a great night and it was really exciting. And we knew we had a lot of work, you know, he was ready to sort of get going on like rewriting and fixing and making it better. And then the next morning we'd learned that he had gone home and he had died in the middle of the night. And it was an unbelievable and shocking event. And we did cancel the preview that next night, but as we'd gathered together that day at the theater, trying to figure out what the hell we were going to do. Michael Greif, our director, and Jim Nicola, the artistic director of the New York Theater Workshop, thought that what would be really meaningful would be to do like a sing through of the show. So to not leave the theater silent, to fill the theater with his incredible words and music. And his parents were flying in from Albuquerque And we could get in touch with, you know, friends and family of his and colleagues and just pack the theater with people who cared about him. And so that's what we did. And it was an incredible evening. I mean, the show itself is about, so much of what it is about living fully in the face of loss. It's not about denying the loss or pretending like it doesn't hurt, or, you know, that grief isn't a part of it, but that it doesn't stop you from continuing to live your life fully. And that's sort of what we had to do that night. So it just made the show that much more real for us as performers. And I think for the audience that was there that night. And it made it, for me at least, and I think for all of us who are part of the show, that much more urgent that we had to do everything in our power to make the show a success.
So what was it like to be the only guy on stage when you sing December 24th, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time? From here, I know the words to the show. What's it like to be the guy that does that? Because you're alone up there, lights come up, and you start. What does that feel like the moment before the show goes?
December 24th, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. From here on in, I shoot without a script. See if anything comes of it instead of my old shit. First shot, Roger, tuning the Fender guitar. He hasn't played in a year.
This won't tune,
so we hear. He's just coming back from half a year of withdrawal.
Are you talking to me?
Not at all.
I really embraced that opportunity. I felt like the way it really started is like I came out with my tripod and I was, even though I'm the only one speaking, actually everyone was on stage. Everyone was sort of like populating the stage, kind of like, here we are. We're actors. We're coming out and the lights were kind of up so I could see into the audience. And I love that responsibility that it's on me to launch this thing. And I feel like Mark in that way is kind of a stand-in for Jonathan. That Jonathan wanted to tell the story and Mark, he handed the torch off to me and I had to carry that torch. And I loved standing in the wings, putting my tripod together, getting my camera ready, getting my scarf in place and just like taking a breath and then just stepping out and holding that, I had to hold the space in which the story could be told. It was something that really mattered to me and I took great pride in and I was very grateful for. So yeah, like night after night after night, the chance that like it was on, the fact that it was on me was really, really meaningful and joyful. And that's one of the things that I miss about live performance is that chance to just be on that stage and look out at our audience and feel that we're all in there together and I'm going to take you on this ride.
You know, as one of the first openly out actors on Broadway, how meaningful was this to you to get cast in this play?
It was incredibly meaningful and for so many reasons. One of the very early joyful moments for me of when I was learning the show that especially pertains to what you're talking about is when I was first listening to La Vie Boheme and towards the end of that song, those lyrics to faggots, Leslie Stikes, crossdressers to people living with, not dying from disease, let he among us without sin be the first to condemn La Vie Boheme. That the fact that I was going to be a part of a show that was putting that out in the world was thrilling.
Faggots, Leslie Stikes, crossdressers to me, to you and you and you, you and you, to people living with, not dying from disease. Let he among us without sin be the first to condemn. La Vie Boheme, La Vie Boheme.
Anyone in the mainstream?
you know, I like playing, you know, people that aren't at all like me. It's cool sometimes to play a villain. It's cool. You know, it's really interesting. I think that's really important too. But in this case, to be a part of something that was perfectly expressing things that I fully believed in was such a gift. And also I think helped sustain myself and all of us through the intensity. It's a really intense show to perform 8 times mm-hmm. a week. You know, it's demanding, it's challenging, it's hard, but the fact that it was material that I could absolutely get behind every inch of it, was really fantastic. And I love the fact that, you know, that I was playing a straight character and there were straight characters playing gay characters. I mean, that it was sort of all, it didn't, none of that mattered in a certain sense and much like Star Trek, Rent, all the characters are who they are. And it's not like commented on at all. They're just themselves fully, whatever they are. And I love that about it as well.
You know, I read that, you sang, Losing My Religion for your audition song.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that?
I'd actually been in acting class for a number of years with a wonderful teacher named Sandy Shuren, and we'd done an exercise called the hero exercise. And in that exercise, our job was to take a hero of ours and do something as them. And it wasn't meant to imitate them, but to find in ourselves that quality that was heroic to us about that person. And for me, Michael Stipe was one of my heroes in the early 90s, just the energy that he had in his performances. And he was using his public platform to speak about political issues. And he was just somebody that I really admired and looked up to. So I had done Losing My Religion in class, and I'd felt really kind of opened up in myself of that kind of feeling of empowerment in performing it. So when I got the audition and I had to do a rock and roll or pop song, I thought that was the only one that really made the most sense to me.
So I well established Rent is my favorite Broadway musical of all time. Aside from Rent, what is yours?
Musical?
Yes.
From the classic musicals, like the older musicals, I would say probably Gypsy's one of them, West Side Story. From the more modern musicals, I really love Spring Awakening and Next to Normal. And Once was really fantastic. So those are, I mean, I can never say one. Dear Evan Hansen is amazing. You know, I love that that musical theater post Rent especially has become more and more, there are more and more shows that feel like they represent what life looks and feels like. Even if they're heightened, even if they're a little, you know, out there in some ways, there still is like an emotional grounding to them.
Yeah, I got to see Patti LuPone do Gypsy. She was unbelievable in that show. Did you see her performance?
I did not. I mean, I think that was the year that I was on tour. So I wasn't able to see her do it. I did see Tyne Daly do it back in the early 90s. And sure. She was incredible.
So, you know, I used to go to the Duplex downtown mm-hmm. in the West Village, and they had that cabaret. They have a cabaret on Friday nights, and people got up and they sang Broadway, and it always blew me away how much talent there is in New York.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming a lot of these people never quite make it or never get to Broadway. Just talk about the depth of talent that exists in terms of musical theater in New York City.
I mean, it is massive. There's a massive amount of talent, but I do think that the true sort of, well, either double threat or triple threat is like especially special when you can be a really great dancer and a really great singer and a really great actor. But a double threat of somebody who's a really wonderful actor and singer, I do think that's rarer. It's one of those things that musical theater especially kind of demands a lot of training. And so there are a lot of people who are very well trained, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they are, that they have a raw emotional availability, which to me really makes an actor really special. So I do think that line, there is a line past which the talent pool gets a little smaller in terms of the people who have both kinds of chops in spades. But having said that, like if you just want to go and hear people with great voices singing, yeah, all over the place for sure. But I do think there is like a kind of special elite class of people who are really profoundly wonderful actors and profoundly wonderful singers.
Normally, I would be going to New York probably coming up this sort of time of year as we move towards the Tonys, and I would go get my, you know, my Broadway musical fill and see some of the nominees and all that stuff. Broadway is shut down like the rest of the world right now. How long do you think it's going to take Broadway to recover from the pandemic? And what do you think it looks like when it comes out of this dark time?
I mean, I do think that whenever that is, I don't know exactly when it's going to be, maybe the fall of 2021. It really so much depends on how the vaccine rollout goes and if these, you know, new strains do respond to the vaccine. But if and when it's safe, I can only imagine like those days when you're back in the theater safely, the amount of energy that's going to be in that room. Those people who are waiting to see people perform for them live and the people themselves on the stage performing for it, it's just going to be so electric. I mean, I got to the great honor of being a part of a song for the inauguration. There were a bunch of theater Broadway performers who were asked by Seth Rudetsky to record ourselves at home as we're doing these days, singing a medley of Seasons of Love and Let the Sunshine In. And then they cut together the footage. And just for me, just being at home watching that with these incredible performers, Tony winners, amazing people that, you know, a lot of whom I know personally, there is something about these kinds of people, their ability to sing from the heart that is so powerful. And it just came through even on that like homemade Zoom-based, you know, camera phone performance.
Yep.
Can you imagine when that's in front of you again? It's just going to be unbelievable. So
yes.
I do, you know, I hope it's as soon as this fall. I, you know, who knows for sure. It has to be when it's safe to do so, of course.
Yeah. Hey, last thing for you. You rattle off the names of spores so easily on Star Trek Discovery. And they are highly confusing to listen to and understand what you're saying. What's the most difficult name of a spore that you've had to struggle with?
Prototaxites stellaviatori is the one that is the biggest mouthful.
That is amazing.
Well, that was pretty easy.
That is amazing.
easy for you to say.
I mean, I had to, you know, I think it's forever now lodged in my brain because I had to like really wrap my head around it. So
yeah. Well, listen, congrats. It's fun talking to you, man. I really appreciate it an awful lot. Seasons 1 through 3 of Star Trek Discovery are currently available to binge on CBS All Access. I started doing that to get ready for this, and season 4 of Discovery currently in production in Toronto. We'll let you know when the date is comes up for that to return. Hey, congratulations on the show, Anthony. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Anthony. Be safe.
You too. Anthony Rapp there. Star Trek Discovery is online at CBS All Access right now. And as Sue and I mentioned, I watched how many episodes? I watched like 5 episodes to get ready.
I watched around 5 as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great show. It's beautifully produced. I mean, the sets and the CGI and the sort of operatic quality of the characters, it really is something. If you're a Star Trek fan, I'm sure you're just eating that up. Hey, Sue, there are 2 basketball teams in Los Angeles, and there is no doubt when it comes to winning on the court, who is it?
Jacob and Ronnie.
No, it's the Lakers.
Oh.
On the court. On the court.
He's in the court.
Yeah, you jumped the gun. If you're injured in an accident and you want to win in the courtroom, that's another easy decision. The right decision is to call my man, Jacob. Doesn't matter if it's car, motorcycle, pedestrian, work accident, call Jacob and his team. They will handle all aspects of your case and get you the compensation that you deserve. By the way, Uber and Lyft accidents are getting really, really common. It's super complicated because you got the insurance for your driver, the insurance for their driver. Uber's got insurance or Lyft's got insurance mixed in there. You need somebody who's been doing that, and Jacob is great at it. And if you've got a case where the attorney has gone silent or you don't feel like you're getting the right treatment, call Jacob for a free second opinion. He has helped thousands of accident victims over the last 24 years. So call Jacob 24 hours a day, 844-24-JACOB. That's 844-24-JACOB, 844-24-JACOB, or remember, accident or injury,
called Jacob and Ronnie
called Jacob. There you go.
All right.
I love
the new,
how
the new and improved song.
I love how worked up you get over the choreography of the jingle. You sing this part, then I'll sing that part, and then we'll sing together.
Well, we're never in sync. So I figured this is a way where we can actually sound like we know what we're doing.
Now, speaking of Broadway musicals, it's like a scene from one. So do you believe in life out there, life in outer space? We were talking about Star Trek. Do you believe in life in outer space?
I do think that there's something out there because, I mean, they've proved that, you know, there is some sort of life-centric, you know, in on Mars. I mean, they've proved that. There's water. So I think that there definitely is a possibility for sure.
So do you think there are beings out there?
I do.
Do you think they've been here?
I think I've met some of them. There are some very kind of alien-esque people that I've met. I don't know. I mean, but I do believe that there is definitely life somewhere else.
There are so many stories about it this year. I've just noticed Message from Another Universe, Next Galaxy Over. There's a planet that looks an awful lot like ours that they've seen through those huge telescopes. I just read a Harvard astrophysicist says he's found alien evidence in the solar system. It's this huge oblong cigar-shaped object that passed by Earth last year. He calls it the Oumuamua object. It's like one of those things Anthony Rapp would have to say. And he says it's space junk from another universe, from another life form. I think this is going to be the year, Sue. I think this is the year we officially make contact with beings from another planet. What do you think?
I don't know. I think it's a little soon.
You think it's a little soon?
I don't think it's going to happen so soon. Yeah. But you know what? I'd be afraid. I'd be afraid to meet some of these people because some of them, you know, especially how it's depicted in a lot of these science fiction shows, they're really, really mean and very dangerous people.
Yeah. See, so. I think they're going to be peaceful. I think when they come, they're going to be very peaceful. I think they're going to land on the White House lawn, say hello, and then help us fix stuff around the planet, like climate change and stuff like that. That's my view. But I really do feel like, you know, because I get ready for the show every day. I get ready for Mason in Ireland. I go through all kinds of stories all day long, trying to look for goofy stuff and stuff that I can talk about. And there's just a rash of stories about making contact and scientists saying this is here and that's there and this is space junk and there's a message from another galaxy and all that stuff. I just feel like we're really close to actually making contact. And it's just a hunch, call it my sixth sense, but I think this is the year we actually, because let's face it.
Did you say six sense or sixth sense?
You know what? Either one is completely applicable, my sixth sense or my sixth sense. Either one works. Anything else going on in the life of Sue?
What's going on? I mean, I'm doing what everybody's doing. I'm staying home. I go out to the market. I haven't, you know, just reading, golfing, you know.
Movies?
I started watching something last night and I wasn't really that crazy about it.
Did you watch One Night in Miami?
I started watching that.
Why? What do you mean you started watching it?
Well, I watched some of it.
Why would you watch some of it? It's a fantastic movie.
I was bored with it, to be honest with you.
Stop.
I really was.
Were you really?
I really was. I got like maybe like half hour in. And it just bored me.
I got so wrapped up in it. The idea that Ali, Jim Brown, Sam Cooke, and Malcolm X were all together on the night of the Ali Liston fight was such an idea. And it was such an unbelievable commentary on where we were in terms of race back in that era. And Malcolm X, I thought, was a fascinating character. Bensley King Adair played him. Regina King actually directed the movie. And I thought that especially Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke was absolutely fantastic. He had some chilling moments later in the movie after you turned it off because you were bored.
Well, it just, you know, I mean, the concept of it was compelling to me. That's why I started to watch it. But the execution of it, in my opinion, it didn't keep my interest.
Wow. You're tough. You're a tough judge. Tough judge. All right. Hey, Sue, thank you very much. Fun as always.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you very much to Anthony Rapp for joining us today. The show is Star Trek Discovery. All three seasons are online now at CBS All Access, and you can get ready for season four, which is coming, especially if you are an official Trekkie, a card-carrying Trekkie. I think there are people that actually carry cards. Thanks very much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. We really do appreciate the support of the show, and we will see you next time on the Culture Pop Podcast.